So,
what's trending?
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
It's Monday. That means it's our weekly happy hour here on Trending. One of those things that just tends to get in the way of our happiness every now and again. I don't know about you. Social media, my twitching fingers, my phantom phone calling up me, but it's really not. You know, sometimes it's just a sound of something moving outside. I love the silence in my house. It's so peaceful, but I still sometimes think that my phantom phone is calling me or texting me or something, even when I have my phone on silent. So we'll be discussing our dependence on technology a little later on today and why it really is good to either quit social media altogether or just work a little bit on some of those habits we have. There was a study that I was reading last week that we walked through on Friday about this decline in marriage and society, and they ended up connecting the decline in religious practice as well, and I thought it was really interesting. They said that as we're seeing the lowest numbers ever in terms of people getting married, at the same time, we're seeing that group of, as they identify, nuns who don't identify as any religion. I'm not talking about the habited nuns. This group of young people have actually even said that one out of three of them have never attended any religious service while growing up. That's staggering. A third of young people today haven't been involved at all in any type of religion in their formative years. And so it made me ask this question. Are we happier without religion? There's been this correlation where we've seen a decline not only in religious practice, but also in starting families, staying connected to your family. And it's clearly influenced the lower numbers of marriages and new babies coming into this world. But what is the attitude of people who don't have any type of religion whatsoever? It's actually really interesting. So if we were to look at some comments from humanists, they often talk about this blissful sense of ignorance that Christians live their life in, and that's why they claim to be happier, because they're blissfully ignorant. We're just dumb if we believe in God. On the other perspective, psychologists talk about this sense of comfort and meaning. In fact, I'll name it. In the Washington Post, there is a psychology professor from Amherst College by the name of Catherine Sanderson. And she claims that religious people are happier because they have beliefs, quote, that give people a sense of meaning and a sense of well-being or comfort. So we feel safe. We feel comfortable. We feel like someone else is in control. So we're happier. As I mentioned, humanist Maggie Ardente refers to this Christian sense of well-being and trusting in God's hands as blissful ignorance. Isn't that interesting? So to believe in a higher power is to make you ignorant and is to make you someone who blindly trusts in things. This is an argument some people say, you know, I'd rather live in reality to dictate my life over kind of creating a false sense of well-being. So why is it, though, that we see over and over again that people who actively practice their religion are happier? Well, if you look at some of the studies, they show that people who practice their religion believe in the importance of gratitude, in giving. They find it important to be involved in charitable activities. We'll actually talk in just a little bit about how important volunteering is. But I want to come back to what this humanist Maggie Ardente said. So she not only referred to a Christian understanding of well-being as blissful ignorance, but she went on to say this. There is often a sense of happiness and the freedom that comes from thinking critically, shedding outdated and quite often discriminatory religious beliefs, and embracing truth. So what she's saying here is that you really are happier and more free if you just think for yourself, think critically, and get rid of those discriminatory, outdated beliefs. And when that happens, you will be enlightened. You will be able to embrace truth. This is in many ways what many forms of yoga and other enlightenment theology, or should I say philosophy, really pushes. You are freer the less connected you are to anyone and anything else. So this so-called humanist perspective is actually radically contrary to the human perspective we understand of the human person from the perspective of what the church teaches, what scripture and tradition point to. That the human person is created for what? Communion. You and I are created to be with one another. We are created not only for the community of people that we are around here on earth, but we're created to be in communion with God. This is fundamental. No person can deny the fact that they were created and born into a family. Even if a mother or a father is absent, you can only come into the world through some sort of intervention of human intimate love, or even today, through a simulation of it, through the means that are being used via in vitro fertilization in order to conceive and create new life. And even those people who, let's say, are brought into this world via in vitro fertilization and surrogacy, or even people who have been adopted. Some of my dearest friends have been adopted. And I have seen them walk through this journey, this search for meaning. How? Their search for meaning has come from looking for who their biological mother and father are. Whether they were adopted, placed for adoption, or whether or not they were conceived via in vitro fertilization. And it's fascinating to me, this desire to be connected, to belong, is so important. This is a fundamental dimension of the human person, that communion of persons. And so I have a real problem with this humanist approach to life, and that they really are happier, because that doesn't really fall in line consistently of what we know about human nature and much of what science and psychology show. You see, the humanist approach really does say there's a problem in connecting the body and the soul. And it creates this body-soul division because we're longing for communion and connection with people and God. But the humanist is saying, no, just use your brain. Just embrace truth. And I'm not saying not to think. Thinking that intellectual life is a fundamental dimension of Christianity. But we have to be aware of the kind of way of the world and how it influences all of us. There's a sense of, well, if I can just control every single situation, well, then I'll be happy. So ultimately, it comes back to this idea of control. And I think of some of our great guests here on Trending. For example, Dr. Susan Caldwell, who shares her fertility journey and her struggle with fertility and even within her marriage, within her career, and all the challenging points in her life that brought her to where she is today, where she's chosen now this life of incredible service, working with women who couldn't otherwise conceive children, helping to address underlying health causes rather than turning to in vitro fertilization. She'll be on at the end of this week to share more of her story. And it's fascinating to me because she points to how her choice to use IVF, and by the way, she recommends it for no one because of the harm it had on her marriage, her body, and her family. But she said her choice to use IVF, her choice to use contraception for all those years prior to that, had everything to do with control. And it's interesting because here's someone who grew up with some faith, came back into her faith. All of us are tempted by, if I can only control the situation, then everything will be okay. And I will be on top of everything. And that really is a humanist, secular type of approach to the world. Now, that's different from that saying that you might hear. One of our dear priests here at the church loves to say this. He says, remember, and he'll say it at the end of Mass all the time. Remember, do your best and let God do the rest. But what does that really mean for us as Christians? This is an important question. You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray, heard here on Relevant Radio, and it's our weekly happy hour. If you have a question during the show, go ahead and let me know. I would love to hear from you. You can always reach out. Give us a call at 1-877 My brain is blanking on our number. Sorry, I'm going to our donation line number. The number is 1-888-914-9149. I'm back in pledge drive mode all of a sudden, throwing that number out there. And you can also reach me on my Instagram story to connect on social media. Just head over to relevantradio.com/trending. So I mentioned this idea of do your best, let God do the rest. Is this blissful ignorance? I challenge you to really ponder this for a minute with me. Because blissful ignorance isn't right. It isn't right for us to be like, oh, well, I don't need to know that. You know, sometimes I see this approach. Some people go, well, I don't need to know anything about politics or how local government works. I just trust in God. And I get what they're saying. They're going for this extreme sense of faith. But there is a balance of responsibility to participate, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church points to this, of being faithful citizens within society. The bishops have written often on this. We're called to participate not only in the legal system, the voting system, but we're supposed to be patriots, to be patriotic and proud of the area we live in and help to build and form that society. And so it really says, no, you have to be involved. But you have to follow God's law and know that if you are acting according to the commandments, according to the precepts of the church, according to the great moral truths, then yes, God will do the rest. But if we're just saying like, God will take care of me, that's fine. I'm good. We're all good. That is blissful ignorance. And I think that at times we receive just criticism from humanists and atheists for behaving in such a way. Now, often, I think even with this humanist approach of claiming that, well, you just need to, you know, embrace your intellect more. You just need to really, you know, take control and take freedom over your life by embracing truth and throwing off religion. It also ignores the fact that we have a creator, that we're created to be with the divine. And if we ignore the creator, that ignores the purpose of life and the purpose of everything that functions within society. And so it really does leave providence out of life. Providence, we could talk about from multiple perspectives, from the perspective that God is really working in time and in eternity, and that all things happen for a reason. Even the timing of being late for church sometimes. Even the timing of narrowly avoiding a car accident, choosing not to go to the store, meeting this particular person at a specific time in history. Providence, think about it, also provisions. God's provisions, he will provide for all that we need, and we will be okay. But when we separate ourselves from our Creator, we have no purpose. We have no communion to direct us toward that communion with other people, nor do we have that communion with God. So it leaves us asking this question. What does it mean to be human? Well, to be human has to do with the pursuit of happiness. If we were to look back to Genesis chapters 1 and 2, we would see this, that the human person was created in God's image and in his likeness. But what does that mean? Well, to be created in God's image and likeness means that we are like God. Not that we are God. We are like God. Well, there's that saying, and I say this often here, but it's so important because it's a summary of understanding the human person, our anthropology, and our purpose. Okay, you hear it all the time. I hate the saying, God is love. Because it sounds so fluffy and ridiculous and obnoxious. I feel like sometimes people will say that in some sort of theology class, and it's supposed to make me feel really good and have these warm, fuzzy feelings. You know, almost like that ignorance is bliss attitude that humanists call us out on. But if bear with me here. If we're created in God's image and likeness, and God is love, then we are made for love. Well, in order for us to be made for love, in order for us to be made in God's image and likeness, two things are demanded of that. That we have intellect and that we have free will. Because in order to love the way God loves, we have to be able to come to know something, have a concept, an idea in our mind, understand it, fathom it, and then freely choose it. If we can't come to understand something, if we can't grapple with it, then we're not really free in what we're choosing. And we're not really loving. You see, God could have created you and I say this all the time, like robots, perfectly obeying every single commandment that he put in our path, obeying the precepts of the church, everything. I mean, just living this perfect life. But we wouldn't know how to love. And his act of creating us would not be an act of love. And so to be created in God's image and likeness means to have intellect and free will and to exercise our intellect and free will. So in some ways, what the humanists say about really using that critical thinking and embracing truth, they're right. And when they talk about free will as a fundamental dimension of critical thinking and the ability to embrace truth, they understand this intellect and free will, but the problem is that they don't take their conclusion all the way. Your intellect and free will is directed. It is oriented toward you being able to choose ultimate, pure, perfect love. That is being able to choose God, being able to choose to be with him, and choosing relationships and good things in this world that direct us toward him. You see, we will only be happy if we live according to our intellect and free will and draw the necessary conclusion that we're made for God. And God is a communion of persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And God created Adam and Eve in the first account in Genesis. It tells us a lot about our human anthropology. I say this all the time. This is really a crash course. When we talk about theology of the body, this theology of human intimacy, as so many people discuss in the church, it's nothing new. It's just that the church is re-explaining human anthropology, and because we've gotten the sex question wrong so badly for the last 60 years, we're saying there's a theology written into our body, and hey, listen to this in terms of your intimate love life. Listen to this in terms of your vocation, because it's all directing you. The decisions, every decision you make, ultimately leads you along the path of destruction, or the path of life, joy, and happiness. This is why we talk about this here during our happy hour. Genesis chapter 1, God created Adam and Eve at the same time. We talk about this a lot. He created us equally, Adam and Eve. But then Genesis chapter 2, God created Adam first. He told the creation narrative in Genesis chapter 1, inspired by the Holy Spirit. He told it twice, God did. Because he knew we needed to understand something. Not only are we created equal, but there's something wrong if the human person, one alone, is on this earth. In Genesis chapter 2, God created Adam. And Adam's looking around at all the plants and animals, and he sees everything around him. And he's seeing, wow, you have a match. And you have a match. That is, the animals make a physical complement to one another and can reproduce. Even the plants and the birds, everything around them, they can continue to move forward their species, to populate the earth. And he found this profound sense of solitude. He was completely alone. Not only did he not have that physical complement, but there was a deeper longing within his soul that no animal or plant could fully meet. And so God said, and I'll never forget, someone asked me one time, probably 5 or 6 years ago, I was teaching a course as a theology student. He goes, how do you know that God didn't want Adam to be alone? That's a really good question. Maybe because right there, Genesis chapter 2, God said, it is not good that man should be alone. We're created for communion. We're created for love. And if we don't have other people, if we shut everyone out, that's impossible. But you see, the problem is, the challenge is that the fall has confused us. As my husband always says, when we read scripture together, especially walking through Genesis, wow, we screwed up so quickly. It literally took us 3 chapters into the story to mess it all up. Because in Genesis chapter 3, we don't choose love. We choose ourselves. We choose to go against intellect and free will. And what do Adam and Eve do when they're confronted by God in the garden after the fall? We see, hey, Adam says, she made me do it. She offered me the apple. What does Eve say? Hey, the serpent beguiled me. Both of them are going against a fundamental dimension of the human person. What? That we have free will. We can freely choose. So you can't blame someone else for what you did or did not do. And so now this is the challenge. We need to regain, after the fall, and now we have concupiscence, that tendency towards sin. We've had this broken relationship now with God, where we no longer see ourselves as creature and creator. Now what's happened is we need to be renewed in our nature, renewed in our purpose to be with God. We need sanctifying grace in order to put us back into right order with God. This is so important for us to come back to that proper understanding that we are created in God's image and likeness. We're created to be with Him. We're created for sacrificial love. I was sent over by one of my producers a quote from Hamlet, which I've never really read a ton of Shakespeare, but this piece reminded me truly of what we're talking about. In Hamlet says, "How noble is reason, how infinite in faculty." Reason is important. It's infinite in faculty. It's a part of what can actually direct us into the life of God. And it talks about how in apprehension, how we are like a God, how in our ability to come to know something, there's something greater about who we are as people. For some reason, it's only when we turn to the arts that we're like, wow, this is so profound. If only we could turn to scripture more often and be like, it was written right there. But this is the beauty of the arts, and this is why people such as Carol Wojtyla, prior to being St. John Paul the Great, was so involved in the culture and making culture and having these conversations and fueling marriages and fueling the acting culture of his time, as it was being stymied by political regimes who wanted to take God out of the picture. And so remember that intellect and free will are so important. They're a fundamental part of who you are. And you can engage with those humanists, those atheists, who say that you're blissfully ignorant as a Christian. Because we actually know we're far more than that. We get the intellect and free will, but we have a greater purpose. And we have a God who loves us unconditionally and does intervene in time and history. You're listening to Trending with Timory here on Relevant Radio. We'll be back talking a little later about why giving to others actually makes us happier. And 13 things about how you'll feel better and happier if you quit social media, or let's be real, at least limit it some. I'll be right back here on Trending. The Relevant Radio Studio Line is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. Information about employment opportunities and their flexible premium life insurance plans are available at relevantradio.com/forester.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Oh, forgive me. I'm sitting here on Instagram. I really need to take these 13 tips for being happier if I ditch social media. It's true. They do make us happier. And just wait till you hear these guys and how it relates back to our conversation of being human. What does it mean to be human? How do we pursue happiness? That's what we've been talking about this hour. If you're just joining us, you can head over to relevantradio.com/trending to listen to the full podcast, because this is so important. What is the pursuit of happiness, and what does it mean to be human? Tomorrow, my guest is going to be Stella Morabito here on the show. Now, she specializes in Soviet propaganda. She's worked for the CIA, and she talks about how social isolation was a fundamental dimension of Soviet propaganda and their tactics. And she relates it to the gender ideology issue and how the gender movement is using the same tactics of social isolation as the Soviet Union. What does this say about today's topic? Well, if social isolation is a fundamental part of the Soviet Union, of socialism, if it's a fundamental dimension of gender ideology, what are they trying to do? They're trying to erase the communion of the human person, the communion of persons. They're trying to erase our need for God. And so this is why these topics are so important. What does it mean to be human? They go together. They address this radical gender ideology in our culture. If you'd like to weigh in on the conversation and have a question related to today's show, our happy hour, head over to relevantradio.com/trending, where you can comment on my Instagram story with a question. We'll take it live during the show. So I want to dive into a really important topic having to do with being better about understanding how important us giving to others is. You see, when we talk about having intellect and free will, as we said just a moment ago, and the scriptural basis for it, and how that's what allows us to love, that we can come to know something, reason through it, grapple with it, and then freely choose it. That's what allows us to be like God in love. Now, in order to do that, again, we had to have intellect and free will, but what does that reveal about who we are? Well, if we go back to Genesis chapters 1, specifically chapter 2, Adam discovers something incredibly profound about himself when Eve is created. There's this aha moment in the garden. That is, he discovers that he's created to be a gift, that he's meant to give himself to someone else. And that's what his intellect and free will were ultimately directing him toward, and why he couldn't find that sense of communion, both in communication and communion in intimacy with the animals, with the plants, the trees, the bugs, and everything else. He needed to interact with another human person. And so the physical complementarity of the body, like a key and a lock, reveals on a material level the gift of self, but it reveals on a spiritual level, because the two always go hand in hand, that I am made to be a gift, and that I'm happier when I'm giving myself. Because remember, Adam was alone in the garden until Eve, and there was simply something profoundly missing in his life. Becoming a gift of self is an essential part of Christianity. In fact, Gaudium et Spes, one of the documents that came out of Vatican II, has this beautiful line that we need to remember that follows on the full over 2,000 years now tradition of the church going back into Judeo-Christianity. And it says this: a person cannot fully find himself except through a sincere gift of self. That is, you and I won't discover who we are, what we're made for. We also won't understand what it means to be happy if we do not understand that happiness comes in giving it all up, in giving ourselves to other people. Wow, God is so incredible. He wrote this into the human body through the intimate complementarity of husband and wife. He wrote this into the human body by literally creating the female body to be able to grow and nourish and carry with her body that child. As we've talked about here, Dr. Carrie Grass and I talked about this last week here on Trending. If you didn't catch the episode, you've got to check it out. We talked about how actually the female body is designed, even with the shoulders, the elbows, the arms, to actually hold and carry children. The male body is designed to carry difficult things on its shoulders and to be able to push and bear heavy weight. It's part of the testosterone development in the man, so that he can provide and protect and be a leader for his family. You see, all of these physical dimensions and characteristics of the human body point in and of themselves to this gift of self. A moment that was a turning point that I so often get to see when working, especially with college students. I was at a college campus, and I've told this story many times before, and I was talking to the men at this university, and one of the jocks there was talking about, we're talking about strength, and I was saying, strength isn't about how much you can lift, how strong you are, what that number is. Strength has to do with your strength of character, because that strength of character is the component that leads you to be able to give yourself to others. Yes, physical strength is important to be able to bear and give and help others, but that dimension of strength of who you are, how disciplined your character is strength of religion, strength in terms of your generosity, that speaks much more to who you are than the number that you are lifting in your weights, how much you can squat. You know, I know everyone's got their own squat rack now with COVID and everyone working out from home. You've got your dumbbells. Maybe you've taken up the Russian kettlebell. I don't know. You know, we can't be distracted by those numbers of what we're physically capable of, even though that is so important. You know, me in physical exercise and Pilates and my background in fitness, it's so important because it does. Actually, the physical strength can form the strength of character if we're going about it correctly. But we can't be distracted by one or the other. And so what does this sacrificial love, this becoming a sincere gift of self, look like? I think a really incredible path of discovery on this was when Aristotle, predating Christianity, came to the realization that really friendship was a fundamental dimension of virtue, and that virtue was necessary for happiness, as was friendship. And he broke down friendship according to three types of friendships. And we've talked about it here regularly on the show. You can catch the podcast where we've discussed it, where friendship has to do with three different dimensions. You could have a friendship of virtue, or you could have a lesser friendship based on utility or pleasure. But when the basis of your friendship is a virtue, sacrificial love, giving to another person, when difficult times come, that friendship's still there. But when your friendship is based on a utilitarian mindset, how useful someone is to you, well, when they're no longer useful to you or you for them, the friendship fizzles away. Or when the pleasure is the basis of the friendship and you're not willing to be the lifestyle of hedonism, that is a pleasure-oriented lifestyle for the other person, they're gone. They're out of here. They're not interested in you anymore. And so all of this shows that really we're created to do more, be better, give ourselves, find profound meaning behind everything we have, everything we are. It's interesting. I've been looking at some of the Pew Research Center studies on religion and how it affects us day to day. And there's some studies that, you know, I don't want to talk about this from the perspective of, oh, look, Christians are so great, let's tap them on the back, because we can be awful sometimes. We can falsely use Christ's name to carry our own banners, to represent a certain type of people, to get votes. And it's so easy for us to use our Christianity. But at the same time, this study is enlightening. It showed people who are highly religious are more engaged with their extended family, are more likely to volunteer, more involved in their communities, and generally are happier with the way things are going in their lives. They also emphasize gratitude more than people who don't identify with any religion. That is that group, the nuns. Not religious nuns, as I've said. You see, 2 out of 3, quote, highly religious adults, as the Pew Research Center reports, says they have donated money, time, or goods to help the poor in the past week. That's actually a pretty staggering number, 2 out of 3 highly religious adults. And going beyond that, they actually not only are involved in religious type of volunteer experiences and giving, they're actually more likely to be involved in non-religious volunteer groups in addition to their religious-based groups. So they're more likely to be involved in the community, in a Rotary Club, in volunteering for a gala for a secular organization. Why is that? There's this disconnect in terms of Christianity versus non-Christianity. This humanist approach says you will be free the more you detach from everything else and just use your intellect. Detach from any type of tradition, whether it's a cultural tradition or a moral or religious tradition or a political tradition even. Detach from everything. Have no connection to anyone or anything. Versus Christianity is saying, no, you are created for communion. You are created for responsibility. And not only are you created for those things that you ought to give to others, that is justice. Justice is giving others their due, what is rightly deserving for others. And sometimes that can even mean when someone is hungry, a lot of time it means this, and they come knocking at your door, which rarely happen, so we need to go out and seek them. Someone's hungry and comes knocking at your door. If you have enough, they have a right to what you have. They have a right for you to give to them. That's radically different from charity, versus charity is giving when it's not necessary, when it doesn't belong to someone else, when it actually might even hurt you a little to give. I mentioned at the beginning of the show how humanists criticize Christians for being blissfully ignorant about things, that God will just take care of me and I have this sense of well-being. Well, there is this sense of well-being and trust and blissful joy in God when we recognize this is going to hurt me to give to someone else. That might mean that I need to fast a little bit. That might mean that I need to make a sacrifice in order to give my time, in order to give my talent, or in order to give my treasures. But I know God will take care of me because he created me for this. And I can sacrifice in the midst of having less, but also God's providence. He has a way of working things out and giving us so much more than what we ever even had to begin with. So why does giving to others make us happier? Because it's written into the human body. It's written into the body and the soul of the human person that can never be disconnected. The two go hand in hand. We can come to understand that we're created to be a gift. We're created to give to others. And then we're created to freely choose it. You see, regaining this sense of religion and this religious anthropology that is ultimately human anthropology in our lives directs us back to the purpose of life, directs us back to this path of marriage, of starting a family, of being more generous, even with the idea of having children. We have this difficult time about having to time kids and have kids on our time frame. Or that we have to have kids when perhaps we're struggling with fertility. And we could be so mournful and depressed during that infertility struggle. Or we could say, praise you, Lord, that you've given me this extra time free of children to serve you. It's part of my own journey. I wanted to be married sooner. I wanted to have kids sooner. But that wasn't what was in the cards in the timing that I wanted it. And so I could either sit here and be bitter and be on that hunt and be distracted by everything and compare my life to everyone else's, which is so often what our society does right now, or I could have this understanding and be reminded over and over again and slapped in the face with it that you are not created just to live as an island. You're not created just for your desires. Your base desires, that are, although many of them are good, you're created for greatness. You are created to give yourself to others. And so any additional time you have should be used wisely, should be used in a way that is generous and sacrificial. And so this actually ties into why good social media habits actually make us happier. So coming back in just a few minutes here, we're going to talk about 13 reasons why you can actually be happier by ditching or having better self-control on social media, and a morning routine that will transform how you live your day. I'll be right back.
Timory will be right back. You can reach her on Instagram and Twitter at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E.
Sponsorship for Trending with Timory is provided by Catholic Singles, a dating app that connects single Catholics based on faith, values, and shared interests. More info at CatholicSingles.com.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to our weekly happy hour here on Trending. We're talking about the pursuit of happiness, human anthropology, and how it's written into our body and soul, yet there's this disconnect in the culture. And in fact, Matthew's calling from Illinois to share about how he's trying in the face of this disconnect in our culture. Matthew, welcome to Trending.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What are your thoughts on happiness and the disconnect we have in the culture?
I think the disconnect is a great way to describe it. And from my experience, being a razor's edge millennial, I'm 34. I went to college in 2005, and I was confronted with Facebook, this interesting new thing, and everyone was becoming a part of it, putting their name upon it, putting their whole lives upon it. And in that moment, I started to realize myself that what I began to post and what I began to express to keep up with the times and the news line and the thumbs up was something that was not my self. It was almost like a digital self image that was beginning to manifest and was separate from what I,
who you really were,
like the
or
little
what
voice in my head that was truth.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, what did you think you wanted people to think about you? You know, back in 2005, 15 years ago, I mean, right on the heels of MySpace being quite the thing, Facebook is taking over. What did you want people to think now, and how do you feel like that's a disconnect from today?
At that point, being uneducated, at least on the higher levels of a college education, I was just ready for some kind of social acceptance, some kind of social currency that would give me more friends. Like, no matter what the cost of consideration, and I would, you know, you kind of sit there with the cursor blinking at you and the ellipsis, and you're like, well, what can I do right now to make a presence and make my social appearance more profound to people? And but in that, I thought that it was something that it didn't quite align with reality.
Yeah. Okay, quick question for you, Daniel, before I let you go here. Do you feel like your social media connection then or even now has ever made you more connected and to have, you know, stronger relationships in person based on the statuses you're throwing up?
No. At that point, it was the beginning of the end. About a year later, I quit Facebook, which is apparently a very rare thing. And my social media identity, and even as it bled into the reality of my social identity to my real friends who I would see in person, was kind of depleted. And because it didn't keep up with that digital arena. And I would just say at this point, when 2016 came around and I myself woke up, from some kind of media daze, I would watch CNN and laugh at The Daily Show. But it was at that point where something really created a incredible schism between what was being portrayed and self-effaced in the media and digital realm and reality. As we know from, you know, Donald Trump's speeches he gives, and then they say the complete opposite of what he says. But I find that the friends were on
Matthew,
Facebook.
Thank you so much for calling, because I want to touch on some of the things that you said about social acceptance and ultimately this strong desire to belong. And that desire to belong is so strong in our lives. And so when you're talking about your social media posts back in 2005 and how you'd put things up and you even say, that wasn't even me. It wasn't what I wanted. It wasn't what I wanted other people to hear and know about me. That social acceptance does point to that desire to belong, but it doesn't just have to be social media. I even remember at one point, kind of in that transition, middle school to high school, and I had this group of friends, and things went south with that group of friends. You know, I can tell you people who I was really close to, you know, it went turned to a very heavy drug culture. One ended up dabbling in so much of their sexuality and lost sexuality and, you know, here, there, and everywhere, and eventually led to confusion about same-sex attraction. And so I really saw these relationships fall apart. I remember my mom commenting at one point about how I changed in terms of how I was dressing when I was interacting with them, the clothes I would wear, and like what my style was even. And it stood out to me even now today in the sense of social media, how we adapt. If we want to feel accepted, we make ourselves acceptable to that type of person we want to be accepted by. We do it on social media. We do it in the workplace. We can do it with family even if we think our family wants us to behave in a particular way. We do it in so many different circumstances, various friendships, and then all of a sudden one day you discover, I actually don't even like this friend that much. I don't know why I'm acting this way. This isn't even me. I have a really close friend who's just had this kind of like soulmate type of friendship for years. And all of a sudden the friendship fell apart. She's like, this person actually made me feel lousy. They tried to control me. And when they no longer had the control, they continued to try to manipulate me. And I just wanted out. I was so sick of trying to become what they wanted me to be. And see, this is the challenge and the confusion that social media can cause. But not just social media, as I said. Our own friendships that we choose to try to find social acceptance in this desire to belong. So I want to tie this into a fabulous article from thehealthy.com. And it's 13 things that could happen when you quit social media. We'll run through some of these quicker ones. You'll get more work done and you'll do it faster. Totally true. We don't even have to go there. It's true. I sometimes think I'm going to go to social media for great social inspiration. Yeah, no. Conversations are way more inspiring. Just saying. Or even just staring at a wall, reading a book. Okay. That leads to essentially you get more creative. Your creative juices start flowing when you ditch social media. It's true. I remember there's a story of this woman who was huge at working for NPR, and then suddenly she had a kid and found herself doing hours of laundry, pushing strollers up the hill, and she found that this came on the heels of the iPhone coming out, and how the iPhone had actually stymied her creativity. But then having a baby and being home doing mundane tasks to care for her family, she found her creative juices were flowing and she was interested. And so she started, you know, all of these efforts to start limiting social media in her life, and is a huge advocate for it as well. So you become more creative. You become better at what you do. It says you might feel anxious at first. It's true. You might feel anxious, like phantom phone is ringing. In fact, I remember when I first turned my screen to black and white on my phone so that I couldn't have a color on there, because the color and the notifications give us little dopamine leaks of pleasure and excitement, and we desire the color and the brightness and all the notifications. Well, I would actually pick up my phone when I changed this, I think 5 years ago. I pick up my phone, I look at my phone in black and white, I look at there were no notifications, and I literally said out loud, I remember being in my car one time, and I think at a stoplight, and I went, wow, this is so dissatisfying. And I put my phone down, and when I wanted to pick it back up, I was anxious because I knew there wasn't going to be anything there for me that I wanted. I had had this addictive habit, and I had to get over the anxiety of not having what I relied on for that dopamine hit when I picked up my phone. The addiction is real. It also says you'll feel less stressed. You'll feel more self-assured. You'll get more sleep. Oh boy, this is a big one. I do not use my cell phone in my bedroom. When I had a smaller living space, I would make sure it was only ever on the opposite side of the room at my desk and nowhere near my bed. I don't take my phone to bed with me or any technology. No TV in the room, no laptop, iPad, nothing. Keep it pure. Your bedroom is your sanctuary in your home. It should be a place of rest, of conversation, of love. Not only will you get more sleep, but you'll strengthen your face-to-face relationships. It's true. You won't be distracted by everything coming on your phone or what you want from your phone. And I emphasize that, what you want from your phone, because sometimes in social settings, we are uncomfortable. And so we want a release from the discomfort. We want a release from the silence, from the awkward conversation, from the pressure to interact. Well, when you don't have that phone with all those little chemicals firing to make us feel happy and safe, and you keep it in your purse or leave it in the car, it changes your face-to-face interactions. In fact, this also says your decision-making skills will improve, you'll argue less with people, and you'll also develop more emotional intelligence. Wow, look at that. This is another key one. When people put down their phones, they recognize for the first time they're experiencing emotions they've never had before. Maybe they're experiencing boredom. And what's funny is because this actually says that you'll be less bored. And I'll come back to that in a second. You'll develop a profound sense of learning about yourself. You'll actually sit less. You'll be more active. You'll be more active. Another key tip here, I try if I'm using my phone to stand up, especially because I work from home. And so during the day, I could just like flop into the couch and be in this abyss of my phone. So I try to use my phone while I'm standing at the counter where it's plugged in. Uncomfortable, find your feet are aching. Oh boy, it's time to put down your phone and walk away. We need to help ourselves to detach. But finally, you're less likely to get bored, as I mentioned. The other day, I was standing in my kitchen. I went to reach for my phone and I flipped it over and I was about to push the button for it to awaken. I never let my phone just awaken automatically because it's even more enticing to use it. And I go to press the button. I went, I'm actually bored. I want to do something that engages my mind. I want to read a book. I don't want my phone. I want something else. Remember, we're created with intellect and free will. We're created for love. But remember, that intellect, sometimes that desire to run after our phone, is a desire to form our knowledge base, our understanding. But that's not done in the same way as it is on a phone, as in conversation and really solid reading and education.